each FlexPass, hundreds of dollars to Grand Central Bakery, and health and wellness packages at Evolution Healthcare and Fitness. We have raised over $10,000 at this time to help shorten the fall membership drive. Remember, for every $15,000 we raise before September 9th, we will take one day off our fall membership drive. A donation is not required to enter the sweepstakes. For more info, visit kboo.fm/2015fallsweeps. And thank you to everyone who has donated early to the fall membership drive.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is coming up just on 9 o'clock, which means it's time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from EcoPlumber, providing sustainable plumbing services to Portland and the metro area, including remodels, repipes, and repair, as well as green projects such as rainwater or gray water harvesting, and alternative materials such as 100% VOC-free green pipe. Information at 503-342-8244 or eco-plumber.com. This program has also been made possible in part by True West, presenting American singer-songwriter and former Black Crow Jackie Green with Lauren Shira, Thursday, September 10th at the Wonder Ballroom. Tickets and information for Jackie Green on September 10th at the Wonder Ballroom are available at ticketfly.com.
Wish I was a mole in the ground. Wish I was a mole in the ground. 'Cause if I was a mole in the ground, I'd tear those mountains down.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM or KBOO.FM online. I'm Joe Clement, your host today for the Old Mole Variety Hour. The Old Mole is something of a political magazine, but for your ears. Every week we bring you interviews, reviews, commentaries, music about history, politics, culture, and current events from a radical socialist feminist perspective. We offer critical perspectives on capitalism, patriarchy, white supremacy, and ecological exploitation. Today's show will feature two movie reviews by our movie moles Denise Morris and Fran Michelle. They're going to be considering two documentaries about female musicians, in particular Amy Winehouse and Nina Simone. Bill Resnick talks with civil engineer and environmental activist Mark Jacobson about how we really can scale up renewable energies to meet current energy demands. And to wrap up our show, I offer some thoughts on the true meaning of Labor Day. You can find past episodes in their entirety and as individual segments by going to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour and clicking on the audio tab a little ways down the screen. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter to find out about recently posted and upcoming shows, and email us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com with questions, comments, suggestions, and even your interest in learning how to make radio with us. And now I turn it over to Movie Moles Fran Michelle and Denise Morris for the first of what will be two movie reviews of documentaries about female musicians, in particular Amy Winehouse and Nina Simone.
Thanks, Joe. We are Movie Moles, Denise Morris and Fran Michelle, double dipping this morning as we talk about two recent documentary films, Amy and What Happened, Miss Simone. Amy Winehouse, who died 4 years ago this July at age 27, had a short but eventful career, releasing her first studio album, Frank, in 2003, and her last, Back to Black, in 2006. Nina Simone lived 7 decades, had a long and eventful career, releasing her first studio album, Little Girl Blue, in 1958. Simone was born into a large, poor family in the segregated South of North Carolina in 1933. Winehouse was born 5 decades later in 1983 into a small, working-class Jewish family in North London. So what on earth could these two women have in common? Well, at least two things. They both were passionate about music from an early age and through their careers collaborated with some of the great musicians, writers, and producers of their times. For both, the power and uniqueness of their voice distinguished them as they emerged as performers. And both are subjects of two documentaries, Amy and What Happened, Miss Simone. Both documentaries take a similar approach to exploring the lives, music, and relationships that shaped the artists and their careers. This morning, in two parts, we discuss these two documentaries, content and form. So we're starting with Amy this morning, Fran.
Directed by Asif Kapadia. And actually, both of these films are constructed largely from archival footage with some interviews and a real generous trove of archive material in both cases. In the case of Amy, we hear from her parents, her friends, her collaborators. There are cell phone videos, there are home videos, photos, live performances, of course. There are audio interviews that are then played over other footage. We see text from some of her songs on the screen as we see her perform. There's no overall voice of God narration in either of these films. So in both cases, we get a sense of a kind of intimacy with both of these incredible performers. And I think both films also make it possible to really see the ways that capitalism and patriarchy had an impact on their work, as well as revealing their tremendous talents and the wonderful work that they both did leave behind.
And even if both documentaries aren't able to really spell that out in a very foregrounded way, it's there, and that's some of what we want to talk about. And starting with Amy, one thing that's said about the film is, quote, the effect of this, in terms of the filmmaking, the effect of this is to make Amy seem not only the subject, but the author of her own story, which I think in some ways is kind of important because as a performer who really was under the scrutiny as a celebrity at some point in her career, she was the subject of a lot of misunderstanding, the butt of a lot of jokes, and her decline was very public. And I think what's really great about this film is that in some sense it sets the record straight as we actually get to see that person before and during the best parts of her career, and then, unfortunately, the aftermath as well.
Yeah, I mean, on the other hand, the film has also been criticized as sort of complicit in the same kind of voyeuristic scrutiny of Amy Winehouse that was part of the problem. I mean, it indicts the press. There are some amazing shots of just a million flashbulbs going off as she's trying to just leave her house, to just go outside, go anywhere. And she's just mobbed by paparazzi. And one gets very clearly a sense of how oppressive this kind of press scrutiny could be. And I think it's very clear that the way that she was treated in media is the object of scrutiny and criticism by the film when we get, for instance, scenes of her being on whatever talk show with Jay Leno, who welcomes her as a great talent. And then somewhat later, after she has had some publicly reported incidents related to addiction and drinking, he starts making jokes at her expense. So, you know, the sense that people can be kind of used up and thrown away is very clear in the film. But some viewers have also suggested that the film itself is doing that to some extent.
I actually saw this twice, and I'll point out that the film has had a long run in Portland. It was at the Hollywood Theater for quite a while, and at our other great local institution, Cinema 21, I saw it once in each location. And my experience the first time through was that film hung with me afterwards. I didn't really know anything about her life. I had only recently brought myself to start listening to the music because I was sort of subjected to the same impression that maybe a lot of people were, that she was kind of this reckless pop star who was drunk and, you know, on drugs all the time. And when I listened to the music, I was blown away. One thing I also took away from the film, as you're saying, is the sense that I felt a little bit like I was let in on something I'm not sure was okay for me to see. And in the post-life, for both Amy Winehouse and Nina Simone, there's difficult stuff here. And often documentaries will paint the idealized subject and not dig into the dirt. But in this case, there is this real fine line between the exploiting the exploitation and exploiting again the subject.
Yeah, and I'm not sure to what extent the film makes clear, although it does make available the readings of the sort of larger context in which she existed, or at least some of that context. I mean, we certainly see the commercial pressure she was under, and we see her abusive and exploitive relationship with some of the men in her life, with her one-time husband, Blake Fiedler Civil, and her father, who was not there when she was growing up and then was all too much there once she was famous and making money, and he shows up with camera crews when she's just trying to be quiet and have some time to herself. I mean, we definitely get a sense of the way that people imposed on her and exploited her and took advantage of her desire for love, desire for approval. At the same time, we also get a strong sense of her own artistic integrity. There's a scene where she's recording with Tony Bennett, and she's like, she can't quite get it right at first, but no two takes are the same, and she finally nails it. And I mean, there's a lot of commentary from other musicians, from, you know, Tony Bennett to Mos Def and all across the spectrum, who really admire and speak to her artistry. And we definitely get to see that. One of the things that most reviews of the film have commented on is this opening shot done on a cell phone when she's 14 and she's at a friend's birthday party and she's singing Happy Birthday. And it's just like, that is the best rendition of Happy Birthday you've heard. And best rendition I've heard anyway. So, I mean, we get a sense of her talent, but also of, like, how much she worked at that and she really cared about it and it was important to her, and the extent to which people around her, and particularly men around her, were really taking advantage of her, exploiting her, treating her bad.
Right, and we do see a lot from folks who actually really loved her and wanted to see her get well and do well, because, as you said, she worked with amazing artists, writers, producers, musicians, and she was embraced across the board. I mean, a white Jewish girl from North London singing in a style, well, in many styles, because she also, like Nina Simone, was able to bring style together and to create a unique sound. And she did that as a primary writer and someone who could write lyrics and music, and as a collaborator with other great musicians. And I think part of the tragedy of the arc of the film is that high of seeing some of the amazing footage, the live footage of her performing, and the fun footage of the Amy Winehouse, who was happy and go lucky and talking about how great it was to have her own apartment and smoke pot whenever she wanted to, you know. And then to see that the tragedy of the tailspin and the end of her life and the exploitation that I think was there as well. Of course, it also has been, I think you began to allude to this, spoken to a little bit by some reviewers, that there's an underlying context that young people and all of us are existing with right now, which is this kind of tenuous, unstable, uncertain future. And I think the Amy film falls a little bit to creating a more individualized tragedy that I think, if given a different opportunity or perhaps usage of footage or information in a different way, the director could have constructed something a little bit more to reflect what he has said in his own interviews, which is he knows where Amy Winehouse came from. He's from that same neighborhood. He knows what those struggles are. He knows what the impact of economic hardship is, but that doesn't really come through in the film. So we do get more of an individualized struggle, the drug addiction, the bulimia from a very young age, the desire to, I suppose, fit that mold at the same time she was seeming to want to reject fame.
Yeah, and I mean, I think something like the bulimia is one case where we could think about it as something that there's been a lot of feminist work on these issues and sort of women's body image and the conflict that women often have around their bodies and their appetites. And I mean, there's a moment in the film when her mother reflecting on like her daughter telling her, oh, she found this great diet and she can just like eat whatever she wants and then throw it up. And it never occurred to her that this might be a problem, apparently. But clearly that kind of move comes not just out of some idiosyncratic individual control issues or excess issues, but comes out of kinds of pressures that obviously many young women have faced, and many young men as well, but more women. That sense of having to both control her appetites and not show that she has appetites and to fit this mold where, you know, the image of the star is the slender girl. And so I think that there would have been a lot of room for addressing some of the larger issues that played a role, that must have played a role in her life and should play a role in her story, maybe in a more prominent way than they do in this film, which is nonetheless affecting and informative and gripping.
Yes, it is. And we believe folks still have an opportunity to see it at Cinema 21, but check the listings just in case. This is Denise Morris with Fran Michel. We have been talking about the documentary Amy, about Amy Winehouse. We'll be returning later in the program to talk about Nina Simone and the documentary What Happened, Miss Simone.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Joe Clement, your host. That was Amy Winehouse with Some Unholy War. Before that, we heard the first of two movie reviews by our movie moles, which look at two documentaries about female musicians. The first that they just reviewed was about Amy Winehouse, and the one coming up later in the show will be about Nina Simone. Now we're going to turn things over to Bill Resnick and Mark Jacobson, who are going to be talking about scaling up renewable energies for today's energy needs.
Mark Jacobson, welcome to KBOO.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
Mark Jacobson teaches and researches in civil and environmental engineering at Stanford University. He directs their atmosphere and energy program. In 2009, he and Mark DeLucci published a profoundly important and controversial paper in the Scientific American. Its title was A Plan to Power 100% of the Planet with Renewables and to Do It Easily at Manageable Expense. Jacobson and DeLucci pointed out that wind, water, and solar power can be scaled up in cost-effective ways to fulfill our energy demands, which could have the most beneficial consequences. That is, it would free up human society from dependence on both fossil fuels and nuclear power, and it would reduce greenhouse gas emissions to substantially end the threat of catastrophic climate change. More recently, he's worked with the Solutions Project, developing roadmaps for the 50 U.S. states for transforming their energy systems. It would meet all of its energy needs with wind, water, and sunlight. Mark Jacobson, how did you, an engineer, happen to become involved in climate change and your project of calculating costs?
I have a technical background in engineering, but I was really interested in kind of understanding and solving large-scale air pollution and climate problems back in the 1980s. But then in the late 1990s, I became interested simultaneously in, well, what are some of the solutions to these problems? And I started looking at wind energy, but eventually then looked at other energy sources like solar and geothermal and tidal wave power, some hydroelectric power, and in 2009 did an evaluation of what are different energy solutions, clean energy solutions to global warming, air pollution, and energy security. And that study resulted in a ranking of different energy technologies, which we called wind, water, and solar technologies, so onshore and offshore wind power, solar on rooftop, photovoltaics on rooftops and in power plants, concentrated solar power, and tidal and wave power and geothermal and hydroelectric were found to be the best options among those proposed. What was not so good was nuclear power, coal with carbon capture and sequestration, natural gas or biofuels. And so we thought then, can we take those wind, water, and solar options? And is it, with Mark DeLucci at UC Davis, we did a study to see, is it possible to power the entire world with just wind, water, and solar? Is it technically and economically possible? That is, you know, we realize it's not socially and politically going to happen overnight. But we did conclude in this study that was published in Scientific American in 2009 that, yes, it is technically and economically possible to power the entire world. There's no resource constraints. There's no material constraints. The costs were reasonable, and the land use is relatively modest that would be used. But then the question became, is it possible to do this at a kind of a smaller scale? Because, you know, you can't really change the whole world at once, but you might be able to change individual states or countries. And so we started with a New York energy plan in 2011 to look at, is it possible to power the entire state of New York with wind, water, and solar for all purposes? That's electricity, transportation, heating, cooling, and industry. And then we subsequently moved on to develop a plan for California and Washington State, and then, in fact, we automatized it to develop plans for all 50 states. So the 50-state plans were published earlier in 2015. Now we're working on developing clean energy plans for 139 countries of the world.
Those could have actually quite profound impact, couldn't they, this, from the Stanford School of Engineering. The plans would really have legitimacy around the world. It would be a tremendous effect, it seems to me. There are now climate action movements probably in every country on Earth. Some are probably minuscule, and there are only about 20 really big polluting countries. And all of those have movements. It would be a tremendous resource for those movements to have that kind of plan. I hope you people really are working on it.
Based on our successful feedback, not necessarily success in getting these plans implemented in the 50 United States at this point, but some progress has been made in New York and California, and even some other states are now considering it. And in fact, two presidential candidates are now have adopted our 100% goals by 2050 as their part of their platform. But we really need to change the whole world, and so this has spurred us to just on our own try to develop plans for 139 countries. You might ask, well, there are actually around 200 countries in the world, but we have data for about 139. Unfortunately, those are the biggest ones. And so we're developing those and should have drafted plans for those countries by November, or even possibly sooner, but we're trying to refine them. And we plan to bring these to policymakers, particularly by the Paris summit.
Oh, really? Oh, that's going to be exciting, actually.
Yeah, it'd be great to have these finished, and or at least a complete draft finished, and be able to present them. They're roadmaps that don't say what's exactly going to happen. It's just they're just saying, oh yes, this is possible. These are some of the numbers in one situation. If we change the energy infrastructure like this in one country or a state, this is what it could look like. There are actually several possible solutions to the problem. This is just one, but I think it really gives people hope based on numbers and quantification that it's possible. Because a lot of people look at the whole problem as so overwhelmingly large that they despair, saying it's not possible, we can never change, it just requires too much change. But I'm actually pretty optimistic that after knowing what is possible and at reasonable cost, too, when I say reasonable, equal to or less than the direct cost of the current energy infrastructure, but less than half the cost when you consider the health and climate benefits of changing the energy infrastructure of states and countries.
This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole. I'm talking to Mark Jacobson, an engineer at Stanford, and directs its atmosphere and energy program. They've developed plans for all 50 states to go completely renewable energy, and in a fairly short time, now they're developing plans for, in fact, 150 countries. It's an extraordinary project and so valuable. Mark Jacobson, you have a lot of opponents, of course. The fossil fuel industry does not fund your program, I'll bet. They argue that it's just too expensive and that fossil fuel-based electric energy generation is still a lot cheaper than this very expensive sun and wind boondoggles. And they just keep saying that. It seems to me utterly absurd. But how do you respond when you hear that stuff?
I actually laugh at that right now because people have said this when the prices of wind and solar were higher. And, okay, maybe at some point in history that was true. But the costs have come down so much that wind is now by far the cheapest form of electricity in the United States. It's half the price of natural gas. So 3.7 cents per kilowatt hour unsubsidized is the mean cost of the levelized cost of developing wind power in the U.S., mostly from the Great Plains wind. And natural gas is 6 to 8 cents per kilowatt hour, so it's twice the price. Now, utility scale solar is now similar to natural gas. It's also 6 to 8. In fact, there's some sales now of about 5 cents per kilowatt hour, so in some cases it's actually cheaper. So wind and solar are competitive or cheaper compared with natural gas. These are the three main electric power sources that are coming online in the last few years. And in fact, right now, I think wind is dominating by far, and solar dominating by far, about 70 to 80% in the last few months of all new electric power in the U.S. was wind and solar. So the argument that they're too expensive is no longer valid. But those people also ignore completely the health and climate costs of gas and coal and the other fossil fuels. And they do this intentionally because they're hiding the fact that they've been contributing to the 4 to 7 million deaths per year worldwide due to air pollution from the combustion of fossil fuels and biofuels, and about 62,000 per year recently in the United States, which costs the U.S. about 3% of its GDP. So they want to ignore and pretend as if it doesn't; these costs don't exist, and those, they're not costing society this amount of money.
Yeah, those are the medical costs, like asthma and so many other things, all lung diseases. But the possible losses from climate change and the catastrophic impacts that uncontrolled climate change is likely to cause, if you believe the climate scientists, and I do, and there's no reason not to, the costs are just on another scale. It's hundreds of trillions of dollars. It's the end of various important productive areas. It's cities underwater. It's infrastructure destroyed by huge storms. In the wake of all that, you can imagine wars breaking out and lots of countries have nuclear weapons, which would be the end of humanity. Do they ever calculate the costs of not getting rid of fossil fuels?
Well, no, the fossil fuel industry doesn't, but we do. So we know what an estimate of those costs are. So, for example, just from the United States emissions alone, so there are two major costs we're talking about, as you pointed out. There's air pollution health costs, which include the cost of cardiovascular disease, respiratory illness, complications from asthma that cause people due to higher medical insurance rates, higher workman's compensation rates, lost work days, lost school days, higher hospitalization rates, emergency room visit rates, higher taxes that we all pay. And in the U.S., that costs about $500 billion to $600 billion per year just due to the health costs of fossil fuel and biofuel combustion. And so that's about 3% of the U.S. GDP. Now, global warming costs from U.S. emissions alone in 2050, so not yet today, but today it's going to be still a pretty reasonable percent of that. 2050 costs of U.S. emissions alone to the world will be about $3 trillion per year, so about six times higher than today's air pollution costs to the U.S. And the world's, from all the world's emissions, the cost will be about $15 trillion per year by 2050. So these are astronomical, but the U.S. emissions cost plus the health cost, they translate, if you want to translate into an electricity price, just to give you an idea, the mean cost of electricity in the U.S. is about 13 cents per kilowatt hour. So for every kilowatt hour of electricity that's produced or used in the U.S., it costs the consumer 13 cents. But the health and climate cost of these U.S. emissions from coal and gas and oil, when you look at over all sectors, is about 17 cents per kilowatt hour. So we're paying not 13 cents per kilowatt hour, but we're paying 30 cents per kilowatt hour, 13 plus 17. Whereas a wind, water, solar energy system powering all sectors is on the order of 13 cents per kilowatt hour. So the total cost to society would be less than half with a wind, water, solar system.
I gather you haven't calculated the costs of the end of civilization and the collapse of production and the loss of
the loss of 8 billion
lives. That's sort of incalculable, I guess.
Well, if we take it to the limit, if the problem is not resolved, I mean, the costs I gave you are 2050, and if all ice melted on the Earth, which there would be about 70 meters of sea level, it covers 7% of all the world's land. And most people live along the coastline, and that's where most of the flooding would occur. Yeah, the costs go up astronomically, even further. So there's longer-term, even more catastrophic costs, especially if we get civil wars could break out due to higher energy costs if we didn't. Because, you know, there's the impacts of the fossil fuel, but the other thing about fossil fuels, they're limited resources. They will run out eventually, and if you didn't change the energy infrastructure, all you'd see is rising prices over time. And once the prices get to a certain point, then you have economic instability, social instability, political instability, then you get civil war, and then wars between nations vying for those limited fossil fuel resources. Fortunately, though, we do have alternatives of wind, water, solar technologies, which would provide a stable energy future because there's zero fuel cost. I mean, the problem with fossil fuels is you have to keep mining fuel. And as a result, those prices go up over time due to labor costs and transport costs and refining costs. But, you know, wind, water, solar, you pay a fixed price up front, and you have that price is constant over the life of the device because there's zero fuel cost. And so you can stabilize energy prices. And not only that, you create jobs by having to put in a new infrastructure. And because wind and solar, in the most cases, are distributed energy sources, like on rooftop solar or winds, you have a lot of different individual turbines rather than big power plants, you reduce the terrorism risk. Because you're producing energy locally instead of having to import energy, you reduce international conflict. So aside from eliminating air pollution and climate change, going to wind, water, or solar, it stabilizes energy prices, creates jobs, reduces terrorism risk, and it produces energy locally, reducing international conflict. So there's really little downside to converting. And so I'm optimistic that ultimately, because the costs of wind, water, solar have dropped significantly, I'm optimistic that we will see a conversion. We're already seeing some conversions and some large-scale conversions. I mean, there are actually already 6 countries in the world that actually have virtually 100% of all their electricity from wind, water, solar. In most cases, it's hydroelectric power. Electricity is only part of the total energy. It's only like 20% of total energy. So we need to convert other sectors and other countries as well. But I'm optimistic it can be done, but people need to know what's possible first. And that's the goal of our research, is to develop these roadmaps and try to educate the public and policymakers about them.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Mark Jacobson. He's an engineer at Stanford. He directs its atmosphere and energy program. He and his colleagues have developed models for assessing costs and calculating the resources that would be needed, money, labor, materials, for moving the planet towards zero carbon economies, every country. And they're producing these plans, or a roadmap for each state in the United States and 150 countries. It's a wonderful project. Mark Jacobson, you did roadmaps for all 50 states, and also discussed the advantages of local energy. Now, the big utilities in the United States, I think, although they seem to be rapidly changing, like in New York State, I just read something, but the big utilities would love to keep their model of big plants, and they do have plans, and the U.S. Energy Department has plans for very big plants, wind plants in the Dakotas and offshore, solar in New Mexico and Arizona and parts of California. It all has to be connected by a big, very high securitized grid and redundant grids. The grid itself would be just immensely expensive, it seems to me. What are the advantages of doing it local? You discussed some of them. It seems to me that there's other advantages, social advantages.
Well, as part of our plans, we'd have a combination of local and large-scale energy.
Right.
By local energy, I mean rooftop solar photovoltaics, but we'd also need power plant photovoltaics, so large arrays of photovoltaics in one location. And even though ideally we'd have everything on rooftops, the fact is that there's not enough rooftop space in the entire United States to power all energy. In fact, we propose about 8% of the total energy would come from rooftop photovoltaics, which is really local solar, and that accounts for about 50% of all rooftops in the U.S. being covered. But we'd also have a lot of power plant solar as well. We'd have distributed energy wind, but wind is more efficient when you have large, tall turbines because wind speeds increase as you go up in the atmosphere. And so if you just had a lot of backyard wind turbines, you're getting really slow, low-quality winds. And so that's much more costly and less efficient than having large wind turbines. But wind turbines are distributed over space, so you're not going to have many of them in backyards. But in terms of having local solar, that pretty much every community can have solar in the U.S. on their rooftops. So that would help people control their own energy. And nowadays, you can also have storage in your own garage with battery packs and other types of storage as well, which can help if the grid goes down or to control your own power. Batteries are really good because then you can generate solar during the day and store that energy such that you're using it at the energy at night, or when you do use it during the day, you're not using grid energy, which is more expensive. You're using your battery energy. So you can save a lot of money by combining rooftop solar with batteries in your own garage. Each person can actually do a lot to transition to 100% clean energy, because everything will need to be electrified. So we would, instead of using gas heaters, we'd have heat pumps, which are more efficient, in fact, than gas heaters, that run on electricity. Instead of water heaters that run on gas, we'd have water heaters that are also heat pump water heaters that run on electricity. Cars would be electric cars primarily. And so these could all be powered by the electricity that individuals can produce from solar on their roof, or wind or solar from nearby power plants that are local to a community, or geothermal as well, and local hydroelectric power. People can use more efficient energy, energy-efficient light bulbs like LED light bulbs, appliances, weatherize their home to reduce energy use. So part of this is conserving energy, reducing energy use by having more efficient homes, more efficient appliances. So individuals can go net zero energy or net zero carbon by electrifying as much as they can and using solar on their rooftop. And this would reduce reliance on these large utilities, although utilities will still be needed because we still do need to interconnect large-scale wind and solar farms and other clean energy farms to the grid. And some people can power all their own energy from their rooftop, but businesses often can't, and especially if you live in apartment complexes or tall high-rises, you're not going to be able to power your total building energy just from a rooftop.
Mark Jacobson, thanks so much for talking to us. You're doing great work. Thanks a lot. So long.
Okay, bye-bye.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Joe Clement, your host. We just heard Bill Resnick talking with Mark Jacobson, a civil engineer and environmental activist, about how we really can scale up renewable energies to meet the world's needs. If you just tuned in, the show started with a movie review of a new documentary about Amy Winehouse. Our movie moles, Fran Michel and Denise Morris, have chosen to also review a new documentary about Nina Simone called What Happened, Miss Simone. We are now going to listen to this second review. If you missed the first one or just want to go back and listen to both of them, you will be able to in a day or two when the show and its segments are posted at kboo.fm/oldmolevarietyhour. And now we turn it back over to the Movie Moles.
We are the Movie Moles, Fran Michel and Denise Morris, back with you this morning to discuss the film What Happened, Miss Simone, directed by Liz Garbus. It is a biographical documentary released by Netflix in June 2015, and it combines previously unreleased archival footage, performances, diaries, and interviews with Simone's daughter, friends, and guitarist Al Shachtman. The title of the film is a quote taken from a piece written by Maya Angelou and published in Redbook in November 1970. Angelou described her piece as the impressions of a poet on a visit with Nina Simone. What Happened, Miss Simone is one of many films in production and is the authorized film with the consent of her estate and her daughter, Lisa Simone Kelly, acting as executive producer. This film deserves to be seen on the big screen, but alas, is only available for now on the tube. Fran, I think I need a bigger TV. The performance footage alone is worth the effort. There are some incredible material here to be used and examined. I did not know much about Nina Simone's life, although I knew more about her music than I did about Amy Winehouse music. We talked about Amy Winehouse earlier in the program. Mm-hmm. So I came at these two films with a different set of preconceived notions, and this film digs up a lot of things about Nina Simone that I did not know, including her life as an activist. I knew she was, but didn't know the extent of her work there. And some other things that I think many people have struggled with knowing and finding out. And the film has had a lot of critique coming from different angles, so we'll try to unveil some of that in our review.
Yeah, I learned that Nina Simone was originally a classically trained pianist. Well, she starts with playing the piano at church. She starts with gospel music, but she was so gifted that the white folks in town decided she should get some serious classical musical lessons. And there are descriptions of her experience as a child going back and forth across the tracks from the black side of town to the white side of town for her piano lessons and back, and being really immersed in classical music and loving Bach and counterpoint. And we find out in the course of the film the ways that this really informed a lot of her music later on, introducing sort of classical motifs into jazz music and really blending a lot of different styles. But that experience of that racial disparity was one of the things that we get the sense from the film was really in the background of her struggles, the larger racial context of racism and white supremacy in the United States shaped her experience in lots of ways. She went on from her childhood lessons in classical piano to have a scholarship at Juilliard for a while, and then she applied to another music institute in Philadelphia and was not admitted. And she believed, and the people around her believed, that it was because of her race that she was not admitted. But at that point, she had to make money. She had to support herself as a young adult, and she began playing jazz piano in bars, and her employer said, well, you better sing if you want to keep the job. And so she began singing, and she adopted the name Nina Simone so that her mother wouldn't be too upset about her playing the devil's music to make a living. But that was how she began playing jazz. She talks about having, you know, she had to play for hours to make money, and so she just played everything she knew, and she began singing songs. So she sort of backs into the field of music in which she became best known and was most successful in.
And how lucky we were, but as we progress through the documentary, we find out that this was a struggle for Nina Simone. She believed by the end of her life, in stating that she feels she would have been happier if she had just been a classical pianist and had been able to pursue that. Now, in between all of that is a period of time in which she, in her 30s or early 30s, becomes politicized around the civil rights movement, and this propels her into a whole new life, a whole different approach to her music, and puts her in opposition to mainstream success, and became a real tension in her life. But she says in the film, I choose to reflect the times and the situations in which I find myself. How can one be an artist and not reflect the times? And this is a very distinguishing factor in the two documentaries between the two performers, Amy Winehouse and Nina Simone, because Amy Winehouse died when she was 27. Nina Simone became politicized when she was 30.
So we don't know what might have happened to Amy Winehouse's politics had she lived. But again, there's the story of the very domineering, controlling, abusive man in her life. In Nina Simone's case, her husband for many years, he was a former policeman, and he quit that job and became her manager when they got together. And for the first few years, you know, he sort of promoted her success and promoted her success to her own exhaustion. There's a moment in the film when she talks about, well, she's really tired, but she's supporting 19 people. They've bought this big house and she's got to go on tour and she's got to play some more shows because she's got to make all this money. She now has all these people depending on her. And so when she becomes more politicized, and not just in relation to the civil rights movement, but really also in relation to the Black Power movement, because she was next door neighbors with the Shabazz family and really good friends with the family of Malcolm X, and not nonviolent. One of the things she says to Martin Luther King when she meets him is, I'm not nonviolent. And he's okay with that. But she becomes really quite militant in her politics around questions of racial injustice. And her husband gets annoyed by that because it's cutting into her commercial success, because commercial media don't want to have this racially controversial figure on their shows. It's not the same sort of thing as she was doing earlier in her career, where she's playing songs from Porgy and Bess and on the Hugh Hefner show and amazing right. things like that. I mean, it's a very different kind of orientation when she starts singing Mississippi Goddamn, which is the kind of political song that she later became known for. And her marriage was abusive. Her husband was violent. And that's something that we hear about in the course of the film, both from her diary entries, which we have the filmmakers had access to, and from comments from her daughter.
Right. And this is actually a point of contention from many reviewers and viewers, that curiosity and anger about the presence of her ex-husband in the film. And remembering that the film is constructed of archival footage from a documentary that was not released, I believe.
Or not completed.
Not completed. Yeah. We have footage of her ex-husband, who died in 2012. I did a little bit of a search to find Lisa Simone Kelly's input on the use of that footage or having her father present in the film, and I could not find anything, but I did find that she had not been in contact with him for quite a while before his death, but did go to live with him at a certain point in her life when she was living with her mother at a time of her mother's darkest, very dark period, when she was her daughter was experiencing a lot of abuse at the hands of her mother. And this is really, really the difficult part, and has created a lot of buzz in the media discussion about this film, which is, how does Nina Simone's demons, quote unquote, get revealed and managed and kind of fleshed out in the film? And does the film do a good enough job allowing us to understand that the struggle of the work, the intensity of the work of performing, the difficulty of maintaining a political stance in your work, the political and historical context she was working in, the abuse with her husband, all of those things had an impact. How does the film orient us as viewers to understand Simone's mental health picture?
Yeah, well, I mean, we do hear later on that later in life she was diagnosed as bipolar. And so there's an opening there to frame her difficulties as pathological, as a disease, in terms of this sort of individualized mental health model. And her daughter talks about her demons, which is, as you mentioned earlier, is a kind of strange metaphor that we use for people's struggles often. But I think there's also a way in which the film makes quite clear that among her demons were racism, were the pressures of capitalism, were the difficulty of maintaining her political stance as the civil rights movement activism and most active phase died down, and in the face of the deaths of many people that she cared about, including Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and so on. And Mississippi Goddamn was in response to the killing of Medgar Evers. So, I mean, she was really responding to very difficult world circumstances and political circumstances. So she eventually did leave her husband and leave the United States. And I think that's around the point when Maya Angelou has this interview with her that she writes up and asks, what happened, Miss Simone? Because Nina Simone has stopped performing as much, has moved away from political activism as visibly. And Simone's comments on that seem to be that, you know, she had not, one gets the impression, she had not wanted to be performing as intensively as she had been. And she only goes back to performing because she needs the money, because she lost all her money in the divorce. And that the civil rights movement, you know, had really kind of died down, and she regretted that lack of activism around her. But one of the ways she's dealing with that is by having moved outside the United States and become an expatriate. And she lived the rest of her life essentially in Europe.
One thing that comes to mind is actually a quote from Tony Bennett from the Amy Winehouse film, who says, "A jazz singer doesn't want to be in front of 50,000 people." And I think in both of these films, there's a real sense about the impact of the work to maintain a career as a performer. I mean, we all can kind of envy that life in some ways, or at least appreciate and benefit from the work of those artists. But when you think about it as work, and when you see both of these documentaries, I think it becomes clear that it is always going to be the struggle to maintain and the context in which you do it that will determine your ability to survive it. So we recommend both films. We've been talking about What Happened, Miss Simone in our part two segment. We talked about Amy, the Amy Winehouse documentary, in part one of today's show. This is Denise Morris with Fran Michel for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We are the Movie Moles this morning, and thanks for listening.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That was Nina Simone with Backlash Blues. And before that, our Movie Moles were reviewing a documentary about Nina Simone called What Happened, Miss Simone. Well, today is Labor Day here in the United States, and if you listen to the Old Mole Variety Hour, you are probably aware of International Workers' Day, also known as May Day, which falls on May 1st. It is quite common to hear leftists speak of one day as the real Labor Day and the other as some kind of gift from the bosses, or else in some way not a real holiday. The story goes something like this. In 1884, in the aftermath of the Pullman Railroad strike, where several workers were murdered by U.S. soldiers and U.S. marshals for blocking railroads necessary to move the mail, President Grover Cleveland and a Congress under the influence of the boss class made Labor Day an official holiday, both to pacify social unrest generated by the strike and to more generally deflect attention from the much more potent holiday in May that celebrated not only workers' international solidarity, but the socialist ends of the international workers' movement. It's a tempting story to buy into because there's a grain of truth to it. But if we try to feed our need for historical understanding with that grain alone, we will starve. The truth is, today's holiday was born of the same struggles that gave birth to May Day in the 1880s. And what we are doing when we regurgitate this myth of the real May Day and the false May Day is denying an opportunity to educate ourselves and the working class about our history. I'd like to now read from and paraphrase an article posted on popularresistance.org last year called The True Meaning of Labor Day, Debunking the Myth by Eugene Ruyal. The roots of Labor Day go back to the Middle Ages. During the French Revolution, a special day in September was set aside as a labor holiday. In 19th century North America, celebrations, picnics, parades, benefits, and demonstrations of various kinds were held to support the fight for shorter hours, to help strikers, and for other labor causes. There are reports of early Labor Day celebrations in Toronto, Canada, in 1872, and in Boston in 1878. The first Labor Day in Australia was celebrated in 1856. According to the research of Jonathan Grossman, however, the American Labor Day holiday grew out of the parade and picnic of the Central Labor Union of New York City on September 5, 1882. Quoting some of Grossman's writing, "The year 1882 was charged with excitement for organized workers in New York City. On January 30th, thousands of workers packed Cooper Union in support of Irish tenants against their British landlords. Under such banners as, 'Ill fares the land, to hastening ills a prey, or wealth accumulates and men decay.' Union leaders expressed the unity of labor's cause throughout the world. Among the participants were Matthew Maguire, Secretary of the Committee on Arrangements, who read letters from labor unions from every part of America, and Peter J. McGuire, who, quote, spoke eloquently for half an hour, retiring among continued applause." Maguire and McGuire, both members of the Socialist Labor Party Club of New York, had proposed the holiday to the Central Labor Union of New York. On Tuesday, September 5, 1882, about 10,000 workers took an unpaid day off and marched around Union Square in support of the holiday and celebrating labor's international cause. It became an annual event that spread to other cities and states as the movement for a national Labor Day grew. Over the next decade, 30 states recognized Labor Day as a legal holiday so workers would not have to lose pay in order to celebrate their achievements. Legal limitation of the working day was an important part of labor's achievements. Even before the Civil War, the 10-hour day movement had made significant gains. With the rise of industrial capitalism after the Civil War, the 8-hour day movement began in earnest. In his chapter on the working day in Das Kapital, Karl Marx wrote, "Labor cannot emancipate itself in the white skin wherein the black it is branded, but out of the death of slavery a new life at once arose. The first fruit of the Civil War was the 8 hours agitation that ran the 7-leagued boots of the locomotive from the Atlantic to the Pacific, from New England to California." Marx continues to write that on August 16, 1866, the General Congress of Labor at Baltimore, quote, "to free the labor of this country from capitalistic slavery," end quote, as the Congress put it, called for a law limiting the working day to 8 hours. A few weeks later, the Congress of the International Working Men's Association at Geneva passed a similar resolution. Thus, with the leadership of the American working class, the movement of the working class on both sides of the Atlantic set itself to the struggle for an 8-hour day. Marx concludes, quote, "In place of the pompous catalogue of the inalienable rights of man comes the modest Magna Carta of a legally limited working day, which shall make clear, quote, when the time which the worker sells is ended and when his own begins," end quote. Riehl then goes on to give some context for how successful the May Day celebrations were. The first May Day in 1886 brought hundreds of thousands of workers out into the street. A good half of them won, and a good half of a few hours with or without striking. A few years later, when the holiday finally became truly international with demonstrations in Europe as well as the United States, slogans included, "Abolish wage slavery," "No more bosses, wage slavery must go," and "The 8-hour day is the next step in the labor movement. The socialist commonwealth is its final aim." Riehl then goes on to describe how the U.S. press distinguished the two different types of labor days and the demonstrators they attracted. It's curious, though, Riehl writes, that Labor Day was started by members of the Socialist Labor Party in 1882, but by the 20th century, the SLP was denouncing it, saying that Labor Day represents a gift handed to the workers free, gratis, for nothing, by the capitalist politicians, meant as an antidote for labor's own May Day. Conversely, May Day was started in 1886 by the American Federation of Labor, but by the 20th century, the AFL would ignore May Day and its own role in starting it. Labor Day, like the weekend, was brought to us by the labor movement. If Labor Day has become depoliticized, we need to repoliticize it. If you just tuned in, I've been reading from an article that I suggest you go and read the entirety of called "The True Story of Labor Day, Debunking the Myth." We'll post a link to it when the show is also posted. Well, that's all the time we have for today's Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Joe Clement. I've been your host and engineer for today. Special thanks have to go out to our movie moles who did a movie mole double feature today. They reviewed two documentaries about female musicians, one about Amy Winehouse and the other about Nina Simone. Thanks also go out to Bill Resnick and his guest Mark Jacobson, who came on to talk about renewable energy and how we can actually scale up production technologies to meet today's energy needs. You can find the show posted online in a day or two by going to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where we not only post the audio in the whole form and as segments, but we also post links to relevant material that we mention. Follow us on Facebook to find out when this goes up, or email us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com to get on our mailing list. Next week, we're going to hear more news, reviews, and interviews from the Old Mole's Radical Perspective. And good morning. It is just a minute before 10 a.m. on KBOO Portland. And coming up this morning at 10, Mike Crenshaw interviews Anissa Farcon about a series of community events called Oregon Black History Heroes and Legends coming up September 11th through 13th. At 10:15, Locus Focus is off. We'll hear an episode of Radio EcoShock called The Unknown Climate with Dr. Alan Hastings and Dr. David Orr. At 11, Health Watch is off. Instead, host Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher interviews representatives from three local organizations about destigmatizing mental illness and a play called Break the Silence, Break the Stigma. At 11:30 on Madness Radio, Dr. Johanna Moncrief discusses the myth of chemical cure, a critique of psychiatric drug treatment. And I want to thank all you KBOO members for your generous support of community radio. Not a current member? You can become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present Arresting Power, Resisting Police Violence in Portland, Oregon, as part of the KBOO at the Clinton Monthly Film Series. Arresting Power documents the history of conflict between the Portland police and community members throughout the past 50 years and creates a space for understanding the impacts of police violence and imagining a world without police. Again, that's Arresting Power, Thursday, September 10th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Elephant Revival, Thursday, September 10th at the Aladdin Theater in Portland. Elephant Revival is a five-piece band from Colorado that play folk music with gypsy, Celtic, and Americana